thanks a lot, everyone, for coming. And first, let me thank Raphael, Peter, Scott, and Yanou for organizing this wonderful workshop, and also for this opportunity to speak. We already had a fun discussion yesterday, and some of the things I'll talk about will touch upon that. But the main thing I want to talk about is nonlinear dynamics that can happen between the end of inflation and production of light elements. In the title, I have nonlinear dynamics. You might want to ask, why nonlinear? I think Ulam can say it better than I can. So I would say, though, nonlinear is somewhat of a norm rather than an exception. And also, it's, for me at least, it's a lot of fun to explore. Okay? There's a lot of interesting things that I'm often surprised by that I wouldn't have estimated by just looking at the action of the Lagrangian, the kinds of effects that that come about. And somewhat more pragmatically, nonlinear dynamics that happens at that time can lead to some scale-dependent observational signatures that we can look for as well. Right, why after inflation, or why the end of inflation, the topic of this workshop? Again, I don't need to belabor this point, but we don't know much about what happens between the end of inflation and the production of light elements. We have very limited observational information, direct observational information from there. And even though this period can be thought of as being quite short, it's about a second or a minute, depending on where you put the cutoff, it's the range of energy scales that the universe is going through, the typical energy scale in the universe at this time is humongous, right? Yeah. It could go all the way up to about 10 to the 16 GeV, and perhaps have information up to TeV and so on. And lots of interesting physics is going on in the middle. Inflation ends, we have to populate the universe with the standard model, potentially generate the matter-antimatter asymmetry, phase transitions, dark matter production, and so on. So there are lots of interesting physics that's going on in this period, so it's certainly worth exploring. I want to mostly focus on what happens right at the end of inflation, and given this very high energy scale, it is bound to be speculative.
Why is it 10 to the 16?
Just from R.
I know. Okay? I'm just curious.
No, but it doesn't have to be there, right? It can be lower, of course.
Below.
But I'm just saying it's as high as it can go.
All right.
Go. Sorry?
How low?
I don't have a bias towards that, but I would presumably you want the electroweak phase transition and so on to take place. So you could go up to there, but I don't have a definite bias towards how low it can go. Now, given the complexity of, or given the sort of not knowing all the information directly observationally and not having a definite theoretical model, as far as I know, people, I would say, you know, modeling inflation and its end in particular sort of fall into these somewhat arbitrarily made up categories. It's simple, or I would say, you know, with few ingredients and whatever you can get away with, so it's consistent with observations. Then you can come up with models that are invented to solve some particular problem that you want to solve. And these usually have more ingredients. Or you could just say, okay, it's complicated enough. I know some general structure, but I don't know the details of the couplings or even the number of components that it has, and try to explore that in some different way. For most of this talk, I'm going to focus on this part, some of the simplest things I can think of, the fewest ingredients I can think of. And I want to focus, even in these really simple models, I want to focus on some general dynamics that can take place here. And give you, not only show you, you know, pictures and so on, but also give you some parametric understanding of when that kind of dynamics can take place. So that's the goal. So with that in mind, let me start with some of the simplest models of inflation that are consistent with data, right? A single scalar field. Generating fluctuations in the early universe is consistent with observational data that we have. But we have learned some important things. For example, if you model the scalar field with a potential V of phi, and say some monomial potential, phi to the p, then data has told us that in this case, it is hard to be consistent with the data if this power law here is higher than quadratic. So it seems that data has told us that the potential is somewhat flattened compared to quadratic in the region that inflation takes place. And again, there's been wonderful theoretical work by a bunch of people, and in some sense, is flattening is there in Sarabinsky inflation. Also, Eva has worked on this quite a bit. Raphael has worked on this. André Linde and Renata Kalosh had written down models with this flattening as well. So these are the kinds of models that are consistent with data. And this is only talking about the part which is about inflation. And I don't need to tell this audience about what is happening during inflation. You have a roughly homogeneous field. It's rolling slowly. You have quantum fluctuations that eventually get transferred to what we see in the cosmic microwave background. But what we are interested in is what happens at the end, right? It's not so difficult to imagine something flatter than quadratic. I can't quite continue it down to the minimum of the potential. I'm going to just give it some sort of a minimum, let's say a quadratic minimum, and try to understand what the dynamics is over there. You expect at least a homogeneous field to be oscillating in this region. You no longer have Hubble friction being significant enough, but it's slowly rolling, and in the minimum, it starts oscillating. This is a picture from homogeneous dynamics, but of course the detailed behavior that happens here as the field is doing this depends both on the shape of the potential as well as how you couple it to other fields. Again, in this sort of spirit of starting with the simplest thing I can talk about, I'm going to first think about the case where I suppress the couplings to other fields and just think about the inflaton field itself. For the calculation I'm going to show, I'm shutting it off. You can just think that the couplings are weak enough that for the timescale of the dynamics that I'm presenting here, those couplings are not so relevant. So let's start with that. And here I'm going to show you a movie, which people who have seen talk before, you've seen this before, but hopefully it'll be, if you haven't seen it, it'll still be interesting. So what I'm showing you a movie of is the evolution of a real-valued scalar field in an expanding universe. It's just solving this equation right here. And imagining this is somewhere, starting somewhere here in the inflaton potential, so at the end of inflation. And what is included here, there is no gravitational interactions in the sense that it's in an expanding universe, but it's not that little localized lumps can interact with each other with gravity. Okay, so there's an expanding background, but otherwise there's no gravity.
And it's classical.
Sorry? And it's classical. The occupation number is quite high. I do put in quantum fluctuations on top of this, which you will see have an impact. But the time evolution is classical. And again, this is something we can discuss more in some of the aspects that will come up about how reliable are classical simulations in some contexts.
The seed is quantum particle production, or it's not?
The seed here, I mean, you can't see, it's about... It's just what you would get from evolving perturbations through inflation and seeing what you would get on scales comparable to the horizon. Inside the horizon, you're just putting in zero-point fluctuations.
So it is quantum.
It's quantum, but they're just the fluctuations, right? Not the time evolution.
No, I understand.
Yeah. So just the fluctuations.
That's all I meant by the seed.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so it's just zero-point quantum fluctuation that you would expect. Okay. So let me evolve the system forward. And the first thing, and I've stopped the movie at this point, you just expect it to oscillate. Not surprising. You let it evolve a little bit further, and you see that there is an instability that causing these, whatever fluctuations there were, to grow. So what is this instability that you see here? This instability is really a... There are multiple ways of thinking about it. One way of thinking about this is that this is the phenomenon of parametric resonance. So maybe I can just quickly write what I mean by that.
By the way, is this a 3 plus 1 dimensional simulation?
We will get to that. Right now, this is 1 plus 1.
Not 1.
Okay. But in two slides, I'll show you the same result with 3. It's just easy to visualize. Right, so if you think about the equation of motion of the field, and then try to think about splitting the field into some background, some plus some fluctuations, and think about the fluctuations in Fourier space, then you're going to find that the equation satisfied by the fluctuations looks something... And for the moment, I'm ignoring expansion. What ends up happening is that when you look at the equation of motion of the fluctuations, when you have a background field that's oscillating, it provides a time-dependent... And if it's really without expansion, a periodic time-dependent effective frequency. This is similar to a child on a swing. This gives rise to exponential growth in the amplitude of the fluctuations. It goes, if you want more details, it goes in the name of Floquet theory. It's well understood. So that's what's going on in terms of why the fluctuations are growing. You could also think in terms of particle production, in the sense that you think of this as an effective frequency. And you can think of what happens. This effective frequency is undergoing non-adiabatic time evolution. That is, omega dot over omega squared can be large compared to 1. And in that case, you're getting particle production because of that in this field.
Are you going to talk about how generic you think that is?
Yes. In fact, it's on the side in a second. So, and this, you can calculate this instability rate. And it turns out that the growth of fluctuations, it's exponential, at least in a non-expanding universe. It's going to grow exponentially. And there is an exponent, Floquet exponent, that you can calculate to figure out the rate of this instability. Now, in an expanding universe, there's a competing scale, which is the Hubble expansion, which can stretch out these fluctuations. So what you want to do is take that Floquet exponent divided by the Hubble and ask how large this quantity is. If this quantity is large compared to unity, you will have a rapid growth of the fluctuations. If this quantity is small compared to unity, you will not have a rapid growth of fluctuations. For the case I have described, meaning for the potential that I've talked about, what were the ingredients of the potential? It's a quadratic minimum, flat away from the minimum, and then there is a scale m where the potential changes shape from quadratic to flat. For this case, you can work through this calculation and show that this ratio is equal to m Planck over m. The m Planck comes in from the Hubble. The m is coming from the scale of the nonlinearity. Okay? If this scale is large compared to unity, then you will end up getting a rapid growth of fluctuations.
What do you mean Planck comes in from Hubble? From the you neglected expansion?
In this video, it wasn't neglected. Here, I neglected expansion.
Yeah.
You can put an expansion by just adding. Like this, right?
I was just asking, how does m Planck?
So, because the h that comes in here has a.
To that term,
right? So, there's an m Planck in there, and that's where it's coming from. So, you can calculate this, and again, in this condition, it relies. This ratio comes about when the field is a dominant source of the energy density. That's how the field is really. Through the Hubble, the energy density comes in as well, okay? So of the field. And in that case, you will find that this instability is active.
So again, if you neglected expansion, what would appear there?
So it would essentially be, so real of mu k is roughly proportional to the second derivative of v double prime of phi
at that amplitude. Order m.
It's order m. It's a little bit less than m.
But the time rate of the process is much faster than the Hubble time, no? I mean,
that's right.
Important part.
The time rate, the oscillations are fast compared to Hubble. All right, so there's an instability. But this is, in some ways, a general thing that I can say. Whenever you have cosmologically dominating, oscillating fields, you will end up having an instability. And that instability can arise, for example, in the case that I've just discussed, because of the shape of the potential, there's also a simpler way in which such an instability arises, which is just because of gravity. Okay? If you allow an oscillating field to oscillate for a while, even if you have no self-interactions, just gravity will start the field, make it cluster, and you will have an instability, so you cannot maintain a homogeneous oscillation. Okay? And this is a very general thing that you can see.
Is there solar radiation here? I mean, can the thing decay?
What?
The question is physically, why when m Planck goes to infinity, this goes to infinity?
Doesn't go to, it goes to.
You said it's a order m Planck over m.
If m Planck is going to infinity, that means there's no Hubble expansion.
And why is the growth rate?
Oh, growth rate is going to infinity. Okay, so it wouldn't apply. I wouldn't have this ratio in there, right?
So what would it be? So that's
Okay, so the ratio, okay, I think I see what your question is. So if I suppose I ignore expansion, yeah, then you would find that the growth rate, roughly, is proportional to V double prime of phi. So this has units, this should have units of mass divided by omega. It's where omega is the frequency of oscillation. Now, V double prime of phi depend on the amplitude of the oscillation that you're talking about. So this will be, let's say we are, it's, you're in the non-quadratic regime, so it's, it will roughly be a combination of, I don't know exactly know the number, but it's a combination of little m and capital M that will come in.
Little m is what?
Little m is the mass at the bottom of the potential.
But if you take m Planck to infinity, you have to take h to zero now, so the combination stays right. Fixed. The, meaning the mass becomes, a, you know, you're in Minkowski space.
Can you review where log enters? Because V is h squared times log squared, right?
That's right.
Is that where your second enters or somewhere else?
So what I'm doing is I'm taking a ratio mu k over h, and this is rho over m Planck squared mu k, right? The rho is the energy density of the field.
Yeah, so you're keeping that.
So this right here will be something like, let's, for the quadratic case, right, it would have.
Can we back up? I mean, the confusion is you could very well do quantum field theory at the De Sitter space.
Yes.
Period. Without gravity, and therefore without, you know, any G Newtons in the equation. Just a scalar field in De Sitter space.
Okay.
So there's a Hubble, but there's.
I'm sort of confused. So your question is why? I think it's.
I mean, ultimately, the Planck scale enters in the Einstein equation. Is
sure.
On the other side, but gravity isn't. If gravity weren't dynamical, I think is the question.
Yes. I think if gravity is. So let me just say, if gravity was not there in the problem, if you're not doing dealing with an expanding universe.
No. You can have an expanding universe without gravity. That's the question. You can just have a quantum field theory in a.
Sure.
In a fixed.
Fix the sitter. I completely agree. Okay. So in that case, I think you would just, if I'm understanding the other question correctly, you just compare mu k to h. There's no m Planck in there.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah,
that's all it is.
Yeah, you're doing some other limit where you're fixing rho. Right?
Yeah, so I'm saying that h here is determined by the field itself, right? So
there's you're breaking the time symmetry, right? I mean, if it's pure De Sitter, there's no, what time?
Sure. But I'm saying that here, the reason it's entering is because the way it enters into, the second ratio comes about because I'm replacing h by rho over m Planck squared, where rho is the field itself. So if you just put in h as a number, then there is no m Planck that appears in the problem.
So instead of m Planck, be 1 over h.
Yes, 1 over h there. So I think it would, what I would say is this part, this is why I was breaking it up this way, right? So this part is just mu k over h. This is all that there is. This part now relies on this field also contributing to the total energy density of the universe. And that's where this ratio comes about.
Not just contributing, but dominating.
It dominates the energy density. So it's the main thing that's driving the expansion as well. So this part is related to that. This part is general.
So do we know the answer to David's original question if that weren't the situation? What would be the
So the situation would be that if this ratio, so you calculate for the amplitude at which the field is oscillating, you calculate this exponent, which will be roughly like this, and you construct and ask whether this ratio is large or small. Now, so whether this ratio is large or small will depend, A, on the amplitude of the field that you're talking about, okay, and what H you put in, and that would be the correct quantity to capture.
Okay, and so far we're just doing free fields, is that the...
Sorry?
Are we just doing free fields at this point, or is V
We have a shape, otherwise this wouldn't happen.
Okay, so then is there radiation, is there any sort of decay of the thing?
I mean, yeah, so there, the fact that you're producing...
These modes.
These modes, I mean, you are going from the homogeneous mode into radiation.
That's all in there.
Mustafa, the V double prime is the time-dependent piece, right?
Yes, that's
right.
It's
not the It's not m squared would not.
No, m squared would not. But I think the roughly the number that goes in there is of order m with a small coefficient in front.
Yeah, okay. If you're on the slope, if the field amplitude is big enough that it's no longer quadratic.
Right. It's, you have to explore it a little bit. But the units of that v double prime over omega, it's a order unity or smaller number in units of the mass given at the bottom of the potential. Yeah. So that's.
So the Schrödinger rate is dominated by that mass scale, right?
By the numerical value. So you need the curvature of the potential to actually, for this process to happen. But if you actually write down the growth rate without any expansion, it'll be some order unity number, or usually smaller than that, times the mass scale at the bottom of the potential. That's the units in which that number comes out. Okay. So this was just talking about the instability, right? And again, it was great because I think I wanted to emphasize this point that this part is general, but this part relies on the fact that the field dominates the energy density.
What is the picture of the bottom?
That's a Floquet chart. So this Floquet exponent that you calculate is a function of the amplitude of the field, homogeneous amplitude of the field that's oscillating, and the wave number that you're talking about. Only certain wave numbers will get excited. And the fact that I'm drawing these lines is because we are an expanding universe, you don't sort of stay in an instability band. So the light colors mean that you're unstable to growth. In these dark regions, there's no instability. Okay. So that's the instability. And as I said, I think this is quite general. Oscillating scalar fields, either because of the shape of the potential or just because of gravity, are not going to stay homogeneous forever. Right? They're going to break up eventually. And again, this, what I have shown you the video for is what happens because of the shape of the potential. This is a resonant phenomenon in the sense that you're resonantly pumping energy into the modes. They grow exponentially. If it's the field pumping energy into its own modes, you call it self-resonance. You could also pump energy into some other fields if you wanted. And then, of course, there's the gravitational instability. Just an oscillating field looks like pressureless dust. It's going to eventually grow as well because of that. Okay. So now I'm just going to play this movie for a little bit longer. So I've hopefully convinced you that there is an instability in oscillating fields. Now I'm going to try to see what the n, a longer time state of this is. So here the instability is allowed to evolve further. And again, remember that this is in an expanding universe, but there's just a field and nothing else. You notice, and again, the movie has stopped here, you notice that the field doesn't go into some just collection of waves that disperse off. It goes into a collection of objects that are fairly localized. You might have also noticed that these things seem to get sharper. They're not really getting sharper. It's just the universe, the way the box, I can't make the box expand, so it's in co-moving. So that's why the object seems to be shrinking. It's just maintaining a fixed size. There are features that perhaps you guys noticed. You know, there's some scale over which they're distributed. Right? They're not, their positions are not entirely random.
This phenomenon that you show here, a consequence of 1 plus 1?
Sorry?
Isn't it 1 plus 1-ish?
Excellent question.
That's what, 2 plus 1?
That's 3 plus 1.
3 plus.
So that's a fully 3 plus 1 dimensional simulation. So we start with a almost homogeneous field with fluctuations on top, evolve it forward in an expanding universe. What you're seeing here now, I'm actually drawing overdensity surfaces at some fixed overdensity, and you see that these objects form. And this is just a looping. The movie is looping. So it certainly happens in 3 plus 1 equally easily as it does in 1 plus 1.
And self-gravity of the field is not included yet?
No. So this is completely driven by the by self-interactions of the field.
Why?
Sorry?
Why?
So there is, at least you can think of this as an attractive, so when the potential opens up away from the minimum, you can think of this as an attractive interaction, and that attractive interaction is causing these things to cluster.
And not move.
And not move much. No, they form roughly at rest. Not entirely at rest. I mean, the movie is not long enough. You will see them move a little bit, but they're roughly at rest. And then expansion robs them of their
momentum. Don't they attract each other?
So the attraction between them should be sort of exponentially suppressed. There'll be a tail, and these things are not, they're localized in the sense that their tails are exponential. So they don't see each other far away from each other. Sorry? They're solitons, yeah.
What do you mean solitons? They're not real.
They're not real solitons in the sense that they're not perfectly stable, but they're extraordinarily long-lived.
Okay? Is there some sense of regarding them as small deviations from real solitons?
From you could, yes. So I'll mention this again, the next slide. These objects are somewhat non-relativistic in the sense that their size is somewhat large compared to M inverse. You can think of them as a collection of a large number of particles with very little difference in their energies and very difference, a little spread in the momentum. So they're almost non-relativistic. And when you write down the equations, you can think of these non-relativistic objects as having an approximately conserved U1. Or non-relativistic objects will have a conserved U1. So in that sense, in the non-relativistic limit, they will look like cue balls, which are non-topological solitons. So this is in a real field, but because these configurations are somewhat non-relativistic, you can think of them as having an approximately conserved U1 charge.
Yeah, so this is a real projection of the cue ball. This is approximately a real projection of the complex cue ball.
But it's
Right, so here was there. Right, so for a cue ball, you have a U1 symmetry. Right. For here, you don't. But if when you rewrite this, you can find there is an approximate adiabatic invariant that corresponds to some U1 number or something like this. Right. And so this can be viewed as a real projection of the complex cue ball case. Yeah.
So the charge has to be really large.
So yes, the charge has to be relatively large. But what is? It is a I would say that, and maybe again, if you give me a couple of slides. I'll talk about this a little bit more, that you can write the time evolution of this field. You can take if you want, you can take a non-relativistic approximation of this, and it literally satisfies the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And then it will have a conserved U1 as well. So that's one way of thinking about it. There are subtleties related to this, because this is a real scalar field, so there is a decay. And the fact that the decay rate is very small is not completely trivial. It is related to the fact that these objects are somewhat large compared to M inverse, as a result of which they're sort of bad antennas. They can't radiate at the frequency they want to radiate at. And that is, again, let me get to it.
The other interesting thing is the distribution of shapes.
Right. So it's not, they are roughly, they're not wildly distributed in shape. It turns out that if you make them too large or too small, there are instabilities that come in. If you make them too broad, then they look like a homogeneous field again, as a result of which the instability that caused them to form in the first place is going to try to sort of destroy them again. If you make them too narrow, there is a collapse-like instability that also makes them come in and go away. So there is a characteristic scale. If you do the stability analysis around them, they pick out a characteristic scale. Okay, so this object, and maybe I should show you this movie, which is also, I think, fun. This is how I actually first got interested in this. Previously, I'd shown you some almost homogeneous field with tiny fluctuations on top. Here, I'm showing you a pretty random distribution of the field to begin with. And again, you'll see that it didn't depend really on the initial configuration. Okay, so it kind of, there's an attractor there that's getting you to this configuration. All right, so these objects have been known for a while. I think first, I would say, by Bogoryubovsky and Makhanakov in 1976. They went by the name of pulsons. Okay, nowadays, we call them oscillons, probably after Gleiser sort of rediscovered them in 1994. There's been a lot of work, and we can go in depth about discussing, and we've already talked a little bit about this approximately conserved charge, at their lifetimes and so on, and I think if we want, we can go on the board and just discuss it in detail about why they are so long-lived. Just carrying it further, what I mentioned a few moments earlier, right? That why are they bad antennas?
The units are showing how long do they live?
That's right. So here I have stopped the movie, but I have, when you simulate them, at least in a spherical symmetric configuration, they've lived longer than 10 to the 7 M inverse, or in other words, about 10 billion oscillations, they're not going away. Okay. This depends somewhat on the exact shape of the potential, but for example, if the model, this monodromy model with the square root, we haven't seen the decay, and we've run them for more than 10 to the 7 M.
This one was from the monodromy.
So this is from the monodromy one.
I know you thought a lot of, I don't want to take you too far ahead, but I know you thought a lot about signatures and found it to be difficult.
Difficult, and I think
that they stay around forever, they don't constitute, or they don't really stay around forever.
They don't really stay around forever, right? Because this is in units of M, which is, if at least if this is the inflaton, actually in seconds that's tiny.
Yeah.
So it's not lasting that long. Of course, now you're...
Although you said you didn't actually see it stop, so you know, but you do have an estimate of it.
Exactly. We have an estimate.
See waves going out.
That's right. We have calculated it. We've calculated the decay rate for that, at least approximately, at least within an order of magnitude, I can tell you what the lifetime should be.
And over those long sounding lifetimes, they don't merge and reconstitute themselves.
This is amazing. I think you guys are all asking exactly the questions that are coming up. They're coming up in a moment.
But do you really have realistic reheating coupling to these guys?
So I don't know what you would say a realistic reheating coupling is.
Something that reheats to Big Bang.
I think it can. There's enough time between.
I know, this but part. Once you do the coupling, then even long-lived cue-balls decay pretty quickly.
So they will eventually decay, either by their own radiation. I mean, these are not perfectly stable, so they will eventually decay.
I'm just saying the question over there is not really addressing that issue because, I mean, you know, these things decay.
I think if you're asking the question under what conditions will these things decay quickly, then you would want to compare, for example, there's a self-interaction, for example, a lambda phi 4 term. You compare lambda to say you're coupling it to one of the fields with g squared phi squared chi squared. You would compare those dimensionless couplings and see which one is significantly bigger. And that would be the mode in which it would decay. If g squared is much bigger than lambda, you would likely not have these objects survive for long.
And those couplings don't help it merge or anything?
I haven't really investigated that, so I can't tell you that. But I think they would go away. They wouldn't survive.
Anything like extend matter domination or do some?
So I think it's hard to say that it extends, because even if this the universe is matter dominated with these things around. But even if you did not have this phenomenon, say you just had a pure m squared phi squared, the universe would still be matter dominated. It would depend on how long, what the coupling would be. So I can't say it extends it, mm-hmm. but it is a fact that with these objects in there, the universe is matter dominated. So let me just say that I mentioned that the lifetimes can be estimated. So what you want to do, one way of estimating the lifetime is to just write down a solution that is, this is roughly what the solution looks like. It's a fixed profile which is oscillating, and then some perturbation to this. Plug it into the equation of motion, you will find that the equation of motion for this has some source term, and roughly the source term is constructed out of powers of this phi bar r. Okay. Powers of this phi bar r, because it's a nonlinear part of the potential that enters here, so it's some powers of this phi bar r. When you try to solve this equation, again, of course, there's an effective mass term that I'm ignoring, but when you try to solve the system in Fourier space, the source term has a... You're taking a Fourier transform of phi bar r, okay, to some power. If this is a Gaussian, which is wide in units of M inverse, when you take the Fourier transform, it's going to be quite narrow in units of M inverse. You want to radiate roughly at least in symmetric potentials, the radiation comes out at roughly 3 omega, and the wave number corresponding to that is 3 squared minus 1 omega, okay, which is large in units of M. Okay. This, as a result of which, you have almost nothing here that is sourcing. So your radiation is exponentially suppressed because of that. So it's all coming back to the fact that this object is not of, even if it's slightly wider than M inverse, it really helps suppress the radiation rate. And again, this, initially I think this idea was, at least when I learned about it, was first in Mark Herzberg in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and Mukaida et al. In 2016 did a lot more in this context. Something that's missing here that we are working on right now is there is an effective mass term to this, which is also periodic, and that actually changes the detailed structure of these things to an extent. So that's why I'm not saying that we know exactly what the decay rate is, but we know to an extent. Okay. And again, this question was brought up earlier. These objects I'm talking about, the oscillon, sort of is supported by self-interaction. If you make this field complex, then you would call it a cue ball. Okay. If you, instead of self-interaction, if you're just supported by gravity, then it goes by the name oscillotron, which is a terrible name, but that's what people use. Okay. And if it's supported primarily by gravity, then and you make the field complex, this is known as a boson star. So this connects to a larger family of things. And again, a lot of work has been done in different parts of this, not necessarily always overlapping with each other, or fields not knowing about different things.
So in the kind of thin arena of trying to test LIGO and test new physics, people did talk about these boson stars.
Though. That's right, yeah.
You had some idea that those could exist at very late times.
Right, so I think those...
So
there are two things, right? One, suppose you made these objects, and I will mention this later, right, that everything I'm talking about really has nothing to do with this being the inflaton. It's just a scalar field dynamics in an expanding universe. You could do this with axions, right? And you can make them very light. And if they're very light, then that M is small, which means you can have long lifetimes. Mm-hmm. So the difficulty, at least I found with the cases with the ultra-compact things that are merging that you need for gravitational wave singles, I don't think anybody has really done an actual calculation of the population of those to see what they are. But in principle, they could exist, and you could do the calculation. Indeed, I think with Eugene Lim and Thomas Helfer, we did this exact question of crashing them into each other and trying to see what comes out. But I think I still would say that I don't know anything about how likely such a thing is, even if this was all of dark matter. But it certainly provides a candidate to look for.
Right, I mean, like Pretorius and others.
Right, absolutely, that as well, right? So I think that was in the context of cue balls, you're saying. It's absolutely, yes.
Oh, okay.
So certainly this has been explored, but I think right now it wouldn't, and I'm certainly interested if other people are interested in trying to sort of start with more relevant axion-like initial conditions for structure formation and try to predict how many of these objects would be there. And really, for LIGO-like things, you are interested in very compact things if you're treating them as essentially black hole mimickers. So you want to see at that end how many of those guys would be there. And I don't know the answer, how likely that is. Okay. Again, Eva, you already asked this question. So if you just look at the equation of state, meaning pressure over energy density, they will give you an equation of state 0. It's matter-like. It's not surprising. The next thing I want to do is, again, relevant to the questions that everybody has asked, which is, what happens if you now allow for gravitational interactions between these guys? They're formed roughly at rest. In an expanding universe, even if they were moving initially, the expansion robs them of their energy, the total momentum. So not energy, total momentum. So they're moving, but they're slowing down compared to the grid. So now what happens if you actually allow for gravitational interactions between these guys and see what happens? And what we're doing is essentially solving what we would like to solve, this classical Klein-Gordon field along with Einstein's relativity, put them together and try to see what happens. Ideally, you want to do it with full numerical zero and all of that. That's hard. So the first step we took was to sort of take the non-relativistic approximation. The field is oscillating rapidly compared to expansion. So you integrate out the fast oscillation and construct a non-relativistic approximation. Similarly, we work with a Newtonian gravity in the sense that there's a Newtonian potential that is relevant that responds to these energy densities, but we put it in an expanding background. So we're essentially integrating out the fast timescale in the problem to get that approximation. When you do that, here is what you see. Again, this is a 3 plus 1 dimensional simulation. I'm just showing you a projection of this. And you see these objects forming. We have tried to at least qualitatively see whether the answers are similar with when you treat the field relativistically, at least in the initial stages, if gravity is not so important initially, then the answers are the same. Sorry? Right, again, yes.
Looks like they're breaking up more important.
They're not quite breaking up, but they're doing interesting things. Very interesting things, in fact. Okay. But first, let me just, at least initially, when we did this, we were disappointed. We saw this, okay? So one of these images is actually with gravity, one of these images is without gravity. I'm sure there are experts who can tell the difference. I couldn't. When you just look at this, it looks the same. But of course, you want to do it more carefully. So what we did was we constructed a two-point correlation function of these positions and tried to see how different they were in both cases. And here's what we found. And this is, there's a lot going on here, so I'm going to take my time to go through it. So horizontal axis is distance. Vertical axis is this two-point correlation function of the positions. The dotted lines are what you get without, if you did not have gravitational interactions. The solid lines are places are the case where you have gravitational interactions. And the colors go from blue to red are time. It's just a scale factor. First thing you notice is that the case without gravity, this correlation function doesn't grow at late times, as it shouldn't. There's nothing causing them to cluster. They're not attracting each other. They're well separated. There's nothing going on. If you include gravity, you can see that the correlation function rises above zero, and it grows. R to the minus 2 seems maybe obvious. It isn't to us, and I think it's a little bit tricky to actually, it seems that all forces 1 over R squared should be like this. At least I can't figure out that the correlation function should be 1 over R squared, but it turns out to be a reasonable approximation.
4D.
Sorry?
3D.
3D, yes, 3D. One thing to notice is also that, notice that the initial time, the correlation function is negative. And this is because, remember when you've seen the movies, these objects are not formed at random. There is a characteristic scale determined by this Floquet instability, right? Which mode grows the fastest. That determines the characteristic spacing between these objects. So there is a characteristic spacing at which these objects form. So it is less correlated than Poisson, right? In the sense that there's nothing nearby compared to Poisson. That's why you have a negative correlation. So it starts off this way and then builds up. And correctly, with the gravitational stuff, you see clustering. Without gravity, you don't see clustering. So this is nice to just verify. We expected, of course, to see clustering, but the fact that it comes out of this power law and the rate at which this happens, still I can't predict analytically. Okay. But we are trying. We are working on it a bit. Okay. Now to the question of what happens. You've seen these objects form. David, you mentioned that you've seen some of these merge. Eva, you asked what happens when they go around. So we'll try to zoom in on some of those interesting locations here. So what has happened is these objects have formed, and the parameters have been chosen so that the self-interaction is more important than gravity, which means they form because of self-interactions. But at late times, it's gravity that is really determining the dynamics. So let's see what happens when you zoom in on some interesting cases. So first, let me show this case. So notice that in some cases, they actually bounce off each other. There are, by the way, again, they're getting smaller because it's an expanding universe. And that's why they seem to be getting smaller. They're not really getting smaller. Here's another example. So this time they merge together. Sorry?
Whether if they're cube balls, yes. Right, Q has a charge, plus or minus. So these are approximately cube balls. What are the charges?
So the I guess the charge, I don't know in what.
Approximately.
Approximately, so they have about, I think, if I remember correctly, more than 10 to the 6 m. Right. A little
bit. Some are positive and some are negative.
No, most of these, well,
there's a bias
to an extent, right?
Because there must be some.
I haven't checked, so you're right. I haven't actually checked what the distribution is.
So it's nice to know.
Absolutely. So because I've been thinking in the real field context, the way I think about it, it is more that there's one field is oscillating, there's another field that's oscillating nearby, and there's a phase difference between them, right? And that phase difference is really determining the interaction between them.
Right, but you attach those phases.
Sorry?
You might be able to see a pattern.
We might be able to see a pattern, but I think most of these guys, at least I haven't checked, but we haven't. So in terms of cue balls, right, you would have e to the minus I omega t and e to the I omega t, which would be opposite charges.
Right.
Or you could just, but there's also the fact that it's e to the I omega t plus a phase. And what we have seen, I haven't seen that minus I omega t. I haven't looked for it, but most of the things we've only looked at things that are differing by a phase with respect to each other.
The omegas must also be different, right, for different oscillons, like
yes.
Tier 1.
But again, because of the fact that there's a characteristic scale for these things, right? So they're rough, they're not very
long enough.
Yeah.
Then time to phase.
Right, of course, absolutely. Absolutely.
And what's being plotted is just the energy density?
Just the energy density, yeah. It's just the energy density. And again, this part is maybe the least surprising. Occasionally, you also see them orbit each other, just point particles going around each other because they've been captured. And I should warn you about taking the results completely at face value, because as you can see, there's pixelation that you can see because we're running out of resolution towards the end. So we can't completely trust it. We can trust the qualitative aspects, but not all the details.
So the background,
yes.
Which has no problem. Mm-hmm. But what is the difference, say, in the energy scale, the density between the bright spots and the background?
So it can be, it's a factor of 10 to 100. So it's pretty high. And the background also, it's not completely quiescent, and there are fluctuations in there. And that's part of the things that I'm trying to understand, like how do those fluctuations interact with this object? Like what is it actually doing to this? You can write maybe the next. So like I've already said these things about, you know, the phase being the relevant thing. If the phase between the two is zero, they merge together. If it's opposite, they tend to bounce off each other. You can write the equations for this, and you can kind of understand, like we are right now with Nabil Iqbal, we are trying to sort of write down in some sort of an effective theory where we treat this as point particles with an extra degree of freedom, which is a phase, and just try to understand what the interactions would be. And you can see all of this quite easily in there, that why this kind of structure.
So they're bouncing because they're opposite, they're the same phase?
They're opposite phase.
Opposite phase is bound.
Opposite in the sense that the phase difference is pi, right. Then they bounce off each other. If the phase difference is zero, they tend to merge. You can make all sorts of, in the real field case, you can make all sorts of arguments that there is a symmetry that the field passes to zero. You can't quite get away from that, so they can't really merge. But there are different ways of thinking about it in terms of saying why one effect happens on the other. And people have thought about these things in the context of cue balls as well.
But if there's a strong phase gradient, why wouldn't there be a kind of a delta function gradient energy between the two?
So there is some gradient energy that's sitting.
So why don't I see that in the plot, I guess, that's what I'm saying. So the gradient energy is too small, but then it wouldn't bounce that much.
Let me think. So you're saying there's almost a discontinuity in the phase.
Yeah, so there should be kind of a domain wall, like a gradient.
Like, I think that we do see when we plot them, there is this gradient. I'm trying to see why the
energy.
Numerical value is not comparable to this, and I don't have a quick answer for you, but we do see these gradient structures. And that's something, actually, you bring up a very important point, because that's something that worries me in terms of trusting non-relativistic simulations. Because now the gradients might be getting comparable to M inverse, right, on that scale. So you kind of tend to worry that if I've made a non-relativistic approximation, am I losing something there? So that's something to worry about in this context. But we have seen, even in real scalar field simulations without doing this approximation, there are, when the phases are quite opposite each other, they do tend to bounce.
Yeah, I mean, that I don't think I'm going to doubt. I'm right. Just worried about this.
Yes, so I think it's, I'm not seeing it. So I don't have a good scaling argument for why that energy density doesn't show up here. But maybe we can talk a little bit and see. It's a valid point.
So, is this a spectator field or the inflaton itself? Or?
This is, in this case, the inflaton itself, because the energy density is, expansion is determined by this energy density itself. So it's fully self-consistent in that sense.
And do you take into account angular momentum and things like this?
In what, sorry?
Angular momentum and things like this.
I mean, it's included, right? It's a full, they're solving the full field equation. So all of those effects are included. There's nothing missing in that sense.
Okay. So, okay.
This is the same system you showed us of the original Hasselhoff. So they had cigar-like shapes. I mean, there were also ellipsoids. They weren't spherically symmetric.
I think they were roughly spherically symmetric. There is some, so we can go back.
Here they're all spherically symmetric.
Initially, they look cigar-like because when they form, yeah. They have these moments. But soon afterwards, they become pretty spherical. They don't have a very, very large sort of quadruple moment at late times. So they, at formation, yes, they look elongated, but they're not very elongated at late times.
The Nicholson directions would favor spherical symmetry.
Yes. I mean, they just want to, it's the lowest energy set. You don't want to.
How do they become spherical? They radiate?
It's partly they radiate, yeah.
I should have asked this before, or maybe later, but
Yeah.
So you start with the usual Gaussian initial conditions. Suppose you had had some obsession, these long tails.
Yes.
And so the statistics of the initial perturbations, you know, on scales, let's say, that have nothing to do with the CMB, so it's all consistent to, you know, have some rare events that are large excursions. Would that affect this at all, or does it all just kind of wash out under the classical dynamics that happen?
I think it's a good question. So I suspect that if the within a Hubble patch, let's say, right, if the initial conditions that you're, or if the parameters are such that self-interaction is more important than gravity, then I suspect all you care about is what the amplitude of the resonant mode is that gives rise to these objects. So in that case, I wouldn't expect there to be a significant impact of the fact that you had some other distribution of fluctuation on that scale. Is that?
Well, I mean, there'd be rare events where the amplitude would be large on some scale. Does that matter? Does it just wash out? Maybe you said it doesn't. It does just wash out.
One movie, it seems like it washes out.
It washes out, but I'm skeptical to say that it completely washes out because you do, I mean, there is sensitivity to the number of objects that you will form, depending on the kind of amplitude that you started with. It's not a huge sensitivity, but there is a sensitivity there.
Okay.
So I can't easily say that it completely washes out, but I think the dominant thing is that the number of objects that you're going to form there is determined by that instability scale, not by anything else. But there is a dependence, so there is a fluctuation from one patch to the other, because there, you would have different amplitudes in those regions. So I can't give a clean answer to that. Sorry.
So, Mustafa, as you know, we have a model for PVH formation when things do collapse, and I guess in your simulations you do not see it. But I know, for example, at Kawasaki, he was showing some preliminary results typing mu, and he, for example, does see it, but we are claiming that, in fact, these rare tails, you can get form formation of PVH. So. There could be also nonlinear dynamic effects and so on. So there could be more than what is shown here.
Again, wait for three slides and we'll. In fact, I'm going to mention your work in three slides. We just discuss it a little bit in this context as well. Right? So, but yes, I mean, there is. We have the simulations I have done to date, none of them have shown gravitational potentials that get anywhere, but they get order unity. In these anywhere. Right? These objects, if you look around these objects in the densest regions, they're usually in phi over c squared is less than 10 to the minus 2. So it's not near a black hole. Does it mean there's no rare events where in some region there is some large thing? I can't say that, but we have never seen them. But it's still, the kinds of things we have seen, I still find it hard to estimate what that, because there are these, it's not just putting these objects and they collapse, right? They have interactions, they have dynamics. So it's hard to really say with certainty what is the likelihood of that happening. But we don't see them in our simulations. With these parameters, we've never seen them, and we've explored quite a few of them. We've never seen them there. And I would say even recently somebody did it with numerical GR, and they had to put in the initial condition to actually see them form. We didn't see them form from generic things. But it could be, if it's a rare enough event, we wouldn't capture it. Okay. What time is it, Rafael? I seem to. Oh, there. Okay. Wow. Okay. Okay, so what I've told you about is when the potentials have shapes like this, just potentials that open up away from the minimum. And there is a scale m where the potential goes from quadratic to this. if the scale m, in the case where the field dominates the energy density, is small compared to m Planck, then it turns out that there is a resonant instability. This instability leads to the formation of these localized objects called oscillons that are relatively long-lived. They dominate the energy density at that time. That is, more of the energy density is in these blobs than in the rest of the field at that time. Not surprisingly, they will cluster gravitationally and undergo really interesting interactions. That's all I've said so far. And all of this began with the, I think, quite reasonable assumption that we have a phi squared at the minimum and flattening away from it. Right? So that was the thing that was it. And we have ignored couplings to other fields for the duration of the dynamics. So that's what we have said so far. One thing we were curious about was to see, what if you change this power at the bottom, just to see what the effect is. And I don't want to go through this whole detail, and Kalayan here, who's done all of this work, and tell you more about it. We tried to just make this, again, this absolute value is just because it goes on either side, and we allowed this power to be fractional at the bottom, and tried to see how does the dynamics change in that case. So let me just focus on the general result that we get, instead of going through all possible cases. We've already discussed a case where this is quadratic, and I've told you that under certain conditions you get these objects. More importantly, you get the equation of state is zero. What happens if you make this larger than one? That is, say it's lambda phi 4 or some power, even lambda phi 6 or some power in the middle between phi squared and phi 6. What happens in that case? There is a well-known result from the 1980s, just about homogeneous oscillating fields, that says that the equation of state, if you average over the oscillations, will just be n minus 1 over n plus 1. Just for the equation of state. We were interested in seeing, okay, what happens when you actually allow for the full nonlinear dynamics? You allow for the field to fragment, and what happens? What we find is that in the setup where this field is the dominant energy density of the universe, and its shape looks something like this, if you're willing to wait sufficiently long, you will end up with a radiation-like equation of state, independent of this power n, as long as n is different from 1. So this was quite surprising that this ends up happening, but it is, you always end up taking this homogeneous field as it oscillates, it eventually pumps energy into its fluctuations, and it gets rid of almost all of its energy in the homogeneous condensate into these fluctuations. These fluctuations, if n is larger than 1, are massless. So if you can pump energy into all the fluctuations, then it's not surprising that you end up with a radiation-like equation of state. There is no mass at the bottom. So, but you do end up with a radiation-like equation of state at the end.
If you had something like phi squared plus,
right? I mean, the previous ones had already had, so when it's phi squared, the minimum of the equation of state is going to be zero. When the mass is not there at the bottom, you end up with this. You could ask, how realistic is it to have a pure no mass at the bottom? And we can discuss that, and that sets a time scale over which something like this will exist, and then it'll again become matter dominated later. But at least for this specific case that I'm not putting a mass there, this is a general result that we get.
You're doing classical.
Sorry?
You're doing classical, so if you calculate the Horn corrections...
Then there'll be a mass at the bottom. Sure, so you could add a mass and you can ask... I agree with them. I think, again, your question will also come up about matter domination coming about eventually, but this, in this limit, this is a statement that I'm willing to...
So by the one, it is the potential is no longer attractive, so you would not expect the solitons, and I guess what you find is that everything decays, or what is the radiation coming?
So the homogeneous, I erase it. So when you write down the equation of motion for the fluctuations, there is an effective mass at the bottom, right? That continues to provide you with a periodic effective mass that continues to pump energy into modes that are not the zero mode. So you get rid of the entire zero mode and go into these fluctuations. These fluctuations, the effective mass at the bottom of the potential is zero, because there is no mass term. So then it looks like radiation. If you're asking the question, do you actually see formation of soliton-like configurations first? And the answer is that at least in the case where m is small compared to m Planck again, even when this power law is not one, initially you do see formation of what looks like this oscillon-like structure, but it's not long-lived. We call them transients. I mean, they form, they're kind of, initially they all look the same, but they don't last very long. There's nothing that holds them together.
There's what happens when there's less than one?
Sorry? We haven't tried that, but other people have. And they have actually, so there's a cusp at the bottom?
Not necessarily a cusp. I mean, it's the second derivative blows up. But.
Right, second derivative blows up, so there's a sort of a... Yeah, I see, sorry, I see what you're saying. But people have done that, and people have found that these objects are there. So these, like there's a well-known, there's a Signum-Gordon model, which is basically just linear.
Okay.
That I don't know if people have done it in 3D, I forget now, but people have, mathematicians have shown that these objects exist in that case as well. The soliton-like objects exist.
Sorry, I lost track. Yeah. You're now talking about a linear problem, so n...
Less than two.
Yeah. Yeah. So linear.
Yeah, right.
But that we haven't explored yet.
Pardon?
We haven't explored, but other people have just written down. Actually, some people have explored this in this context as well and found these solitonic objects to exist.
And you said those are on the long-lived side of things.
I think the claim is they're on the long-lived side, but I don't have a number for you. In terms of how long they are.
And I'm really sorry.
Yeah, sure.
But the equation of state ends up in that case being?
We haven't looked at it. So I haven't at all explored the n less than one case, meaning the things that are not quadratic.
I think that's more like top-down natural than the let's tune and ask to zero case,
okay.
To be honest.
So what would you expect?
It just has to do with, we go back to Sayles monogamy example, it has to do, let's say this wind-up Fourier example, just has to do with how close they are.
But really, so the V double prime is zero, I mean, ill-defined, that's fine?
I think it's just a limit, and then, of course you want to then ask what is the UV physics of that cusp.
Yes.
But I'm just saying, I think that is within the realm of known parameters. I have to, if you're really interested, I should remind myself.
No, I would be.
It's in some other context that this question came up. I thought about it, and everybody involved got convinced by this statement. I'd have to revisit it to remember why, but I think it's fine.
Yeah, I have to look back at, so I think the people who have explored this, one of the authors, I don't remember all the other authors, and I apologize to them, but it was Gary Hsu has worked on. He's on papers where he's dealt with this, where there's a cusp at the bottom.
It's not really crossover at all.
Okay. So and he's worked on this and found these objects to be there as well. But again,
it's
I...
So you would expect that to be zero?
I would expect that, because if you have objects that dominate the energy density, then the total W will be zero.
Right. But the question of how long they live, what was the state?
Probably longer.
I think they live long. Again, I'm sorry, I just don't have the...
I don't know
the answer whether they're longer than this. I just haven't explored that. I've only looked at what people have done in that context. I don't have an answer for you. In the 1 plus 1D case, the previous results, not in this context, people have shown that they live really a really long time, essentially an infinitely long time in the Signum-Gordon model where it's linear. But in 3 plus 1D, I don't have an answer of how long they live.
But in 1 plus 1D, that is longer than the usual.
No.
It's just the same.
It's just the same. Because 1 plus 1D is really
okay,
smaller than
1D.
It's no real...
There's no worse.
There's no worse.
Okay.
So I can't... And it's also, I'm making these statements because these are things I know. I know they're not the most relevant thing for the 3 plus 1D.
What about the flat-top oscillons? Can you remind me what
So that's, again... I didn't... There was too much in here to mention, so... If there's another, so here I've talked about potentials that open up away from the minimum. Again, the first things that we explored a long time ago was potentials that are phi squared, then minus lambda phi 4, and then a phi 6. So they have some region where they open up away from the minimum, and then they close off again. In that case, you find that the objects that form their profiles, so right now most of these objects have a profile that roughly looks Gaussian, that I've shown. In the case where the potential is phi squared minus lambda phi 4 plus phi 6, in that case, you will find that as you go to larger amplitudes, the objects actually start looking like this. So this is phi of r versus phi. This is related to the fact that this term is becoming important. Okay, so there's sort of a wall, and they can't go beyond a certain amplitude. So they basically start getting bigger. But again, not all, as I've said before, there's a characteristic scale. As this gets bigger, this starts looking like a homogeneous field. And if it starts looking like a homogeneous field, the parametric resonance that caused these to form in the first place, these small fluctuations, start thinking of this as a homogeneous field, and they tend to try to destroy them. There's again, even there, there's a scale in the problem. So these, we call them fractal oscillations.
Sorry, keep interrupting. Eva, I didn't get your point. You were saying n less than 1 is more natural.
Well, first of all, we were talking about maybe a slightly different thing. The flattening is natural just because that's just energetics. Yes. Once you couple to anything else, by energetics, the potential will tend to have this opening up aspect. We had, top-down models that were doing that, and then later it became clear that it's just a very pedestrian thing. Why? So that part, I think, I would argue that that's natural.
But that's true.
That's a different end, yeah. Sorry.
Well, but I guess there's different scales, right? So there's this scale, M, and below that scale, it scales like, it's still
I agree.
Fraction like that, and then at the very bottom, it's still going to be quadratic. That's what you know by the unit.
Well, the thing is, I agree there's a different question, which is there a regime where you understand this cusp thing? And I think it's true that that is available. Now, all I was saying is it's more, it's there's nothing about that that's not radiatively stable. Because in effect, the quadratic piece is in there. It's not like it's being tuned away. I should think about Mark, it's really something of use here, because I haven't thought about it in a while, but this question has come up before.
I think it depends just on the amplitude, so I think there should be a regime where this is relevant, right? Where you're not really seeing that there's a tiny little swirling out of space.
Yeah, exactly. But I guess nobody is sure how much of a difference that makes in this.
I think you would. So, Eva, just to clarify, so there's a power law here, which you've said from your earlier work, that this can be made. Alpha can be less than 1.
These are different, yeah.
Right, but this, so you're saying this, what is, so this scale in the model that you thought of, this can be small compared, somewhat small compared to M Planck? Right, that's the, and what about, so here somewhere it becomes quadratic. I'm trying to understand what this scale.
What is it, the mass?
Yeah, well, this is a field, right? I'm expecting there's eventually a quadratic part at the bottom.
Very small. They were playing with this with Yosu, I guess, with the numerical simulations in literally this model.
I think it's a parameter.
Okay. I just want to understand what this hierarchy between this scale where,
Is it natural in the sense of just throwing a dart or you can land there? that is. Tricky thing to ask. I think there's something special about the cusp case, which may mean that it's like a more symmetric situation in some sense. You just let it.
I see. What's the one loop effective potential there? You're saying it's exactly zero?
I mean, nobody's saying there's not really a mass there.
Okay. Then what's another scale? So there's a big M, and then I don't know what you want to call the other one, maybe not little M, because that's usually what we call the mass.
Let's call it lambda.
Some other scale, okay. Lambda, let's say below lambda, then...
I know, but all you have to do is compute V double prime squared. That's your effective potential. That's the one loop effective potential, right?
So notice that V double prime in the linear regime is... zero.
Yeah, except you get obviously corrections even from gravity.
Yeah, but gravitational, gravitational corrections, as you say, are always there. Those do not destroy radiative stability, say, of the other.
Yeah, but they will give you an unsquared term.
But it's small.
Yeah, it's small. But I'm saying, so there's a lower bound on that.
Yeah, there's a...
And then...
But it's all suppressed.
Right? Yeah, and then if you add any higher dimensional operators with your linear or any power expansion, you're going to get leading corrections.
But there one has to not just Taylor expand in general, right? That's
unless if your V prime is zero, right?
I mean, I'm saying you're looking at a very, I mean, V double prime at zero, you're looking at a very.
No, but I mean, let's say, I think this, I mean, I don't want to derail.
No, please, that's fine.
And personally, I need to go back to this question again if it is actually useful, because we are kind of vaguely remembering that it's fine. But your question about the stability, you could have asked about the inflationary models in the first place. Okay, and that we spent a lot of time on, right? So it's, first of all, it's as radius of stable, or actually more so than.
I'm not claiming it's unstable. I'm just saying it's easy to estimate his little mass. That's all I was saying.
Okay.
I'm not claiming what you were saying was unstable.
Okay. Sounds good.
Sorry. He was asking a question about that.
I'm confused.
No, you're saying.
But V double prime, you said, but here again, I think you were saying the same thing. V double prime is zero, but you're saying it's that scale was V double prime.
Well, V double prime isn't exactly zero.
So what is the?
So you know, you have suppressed operators other than the linear term. This linear term is obviously not an exact potential.
Okay, and you could.
Right. But hopefully we agree that one of the lessons, which is admittedly trivial, like again, is it's not that you'd start somewhere and then start adding those operators in a Taylor expansion. One has already done some summation into, like in this linear model, say it's some square root formula, and the idea of Taylor expanding is an idea that's valid if you're not interested in field ranges larger than this.
I agree, but he was asking a very tiny
good
field level question.
No, sorry. Yeah. Thanks.
Right. Let me just okay. Maybe I shouldn't spend too much time on this anymore. Again, the case we have discussed for most of the talk was just you get these objects and you get equation of state of zero. For the case where you don't have a mass, at the bottom you will get equation of state 1/3 eventually. There's a time period where it's n minus 1 over n plus 1, the usual result, but then eventually you do get here. And you can see this roughly because then you calculate that Floquet exponent divided by h. If you just roughly try to estimate it, it goes inversely with the amplitude of the homogeneous field. So you become more and more effective at producing quanta that you want to go into. And that's why this, it always ends up in that state. That's why this thing is going on. All right, Eva, you had initially asked me implications. I'm not going to tell you that this is, anything I'm going to tell you is an easy implication that we can see tomorrow. But at least the things we have calculated, I can mention. So one effect, which is, you know, let's start with, and I'm not going to talk about the non-gravitational effects because you'll have to tell me what it couples to, and that will become model dependent in terms of what you want to do. So let's just talk about the gravitational effects of these things. And the first thing I want to do is talk about some homogeneous things. I told you something about the equation of state when this power law was not equal to 1. Why did we want to investigate this? Because here what is going on is, even when you're not coupling to any field, you're still getting to radiation domination. So if you decide to couple to other fields, massless fields, then you will only get to radiation domination faster. So this, in this limited sense, it gives you a bound on how long it takes from the end of inflation to radiation domination. And what that does is, that's the main source of uncertainty when we plot these dumbbells here, whether it's matter-dominated, radiation-dominated. So in these models, when the bottom doesn't have a mass, you do have a bound on how long it takes to get to radiation domination. You can actually calculate that bound, and it shrinks this uncertainty significantly. But again, it's under the assumption that you have no mass at the bottom, at least in this scale. So in that case, it does give you this this bound, which I think it's interesting. Lord, you asked about formation of primordial black holes from this. One of the things we initially, even when we had first done the simulation, I think the one when Rafael and I were working this a long time ago, along with Richard and company, we had found that just take these objects from your simulations and just estimate the gravitational potential. It was never large. For none of the cases we ever found it larger than 10 to the minus 2. Recently with Kaloyan, we just calculated explicitly from the code itself. And again, I don't want to go into detail, we plotted the distribution of the gravitational potential around these objects. We appropriately normalized it, and so on. And it was never large. However, what I think Eric Kottner, Alex Kusenko and Laud and company have been arguing, which is an interesting idea, which is, sure, it's not easy to form primordial black holes from individual objects, but there might be accidentally over densities where enough of them just happen to be there that they might collapse into a black hole. So that's the argument, and I think what you're going to talk, you're going to discuss this further. So my question right now in the simulations or the estimates, I can't estimate how likely this will be because it seems to depend on a lot of factors in terms of, you know, I can't see them in my simulations, and I can't easily write down a Twiddle argument that will tell you what the number, a predictive number would be. But I think Vlad will tell.
Again, this is radiation nomination.
This is not. No.
This is just generic.
So yeah, I've got. This is just matter. This is just clumps. This is matter domination. So this has nothing to do with. Sorry, I switched too quickly. So this was with radiation domination. Now I'm back because these solitons are forming. I'm now talking about just back to the matter dominated scenario.
This is the infoton fragmenting.
Yeah, infoton fragmenting. This is the case with the infoton fragmenting. We have never seen anything. And again, I worry about the phenomena that have. You've seen of how they scatter off each other even when they're close by to actually say something definitive about what the likelihood of this is. And I should mention that recently, as I said, this group a few weeks ago also put out trying to do this with full numerical general relativity. And they, from the initial conditions, they didn't see a black hole form. Maybe I'll skip this again. This is, again, people are familiar with this. There's fragmentation of these of a field. You're going to generate gravitational waves, if this, especially if it's the dominant energy density in the universe. This is the fraction of energy density in gravitational waves today versus the frequency. If this is a high, if this process is happening at very early times, the frequency will be very high. A good way of estimating it, this is just, it's the square root of the Hubble scale when this process is taking place, times H naught, which is today, the stakes here of the redshifting. Omega GW typically is of order 10 to the minus 9. This, when I move this peak, I've sort of allowed this not necessarily to be the inflaton and things like that. There are more restrictions on what this peak can be. One thing that I think maybe Zach and Peter, I don't know if, are you giving a talk? Okay. So they did this I'm talking about just a single scalar field model, but when you couple it to other fields, you can actually boost this peak, especially with gauge fields and so on. And in some models with strong coupling to gauge fields, you can boost it enough that it contributes to the radiation energy budget of the universe, and you can try to constrain it with something like ineffective. And again, I would exercise caution in over-interpreting these things because they do depend on what the expansion history of the universe is after this production is and things like that. So there are lots of subtleties in actually translating into a signal to see today. Okay, so I've told you about nonlinear dynamics of scalar fields, particularly at the end of inflation. I've really focused on a single scalar field, and I've told you that there's an instability in oscillating scalar fields. There's formation of solitons, at least when the m squared phi squared at the bottom. I've told you about equation of state when the potential is not m squared phi squared at the bottom. Talked about gravitational waves, clustering, expansion history, and so on. For a number of people in the audience, perhaps, instead of thinking about the end of inflation, you might be thinking about axions. A lot of these things carry over. Okay, so there are novel connections. You think about axionic dark matter. Recently, we've done simulations with baryons and so on. And again, there, the soliton-like configurations form there again. But there, it's mostly because of gravity, not because of self-interactions that is driven. Then, of course, there's the Arrhenius-Taki et al. They have also investigated recently the formation of these objects and their implication in the axion case. For the case where you don't have a quadratic minimum, there's a connection to this a solution to the Hubble tension. It turns out that when people propose a solution to the Hubble tension with a non-quadratic minimum, which is what is needed, these resonance-like effects that lead to fragmentation of the field are active there as well. So that could give rise to some interesting phenomenology there, if you're interested. And again, many of these things are, I've certainly learned a lot because the solitons and things like that, at least in the non-relativistic limit, you can actually simulate them, not simulate them, sorry, experimentally make them in the lab in Bose-Einstein condensates. And so this is from my colleague Randy Hewlett's lab at Rice. These are actually, it's effectively, these are solid, the colors are energy densities, or the number densities of the atoms. And you can see this is a train of solitons form, and they can also make them collide and see this phase difference that I was talking about, what happens when they interact. They bounce off each other, and so this can be done in the lab. And people have been investigating this quite a bit.
Can you say a little bit more about the early dark energy?
Sure. So let me see. I'm not going to talk about all of this, sorry. So here is... So the early dark energy models that were proposed by some of these authors, the first ones that were proposed, they basically had a scale, they proposed a scalar field with a, let's say for the sake of argument, lambda phi 4 potential. And you need lambda phi 4 because you want this energy density to redshift faster than matter. You want it to redshift as radiation. In case you do that, what ends up happening is that because this potential is not quadratic here, again, in not all parameter regions, but especially in the case when this is quadratic, you end up seeing that there is a rapid growth of instability in this early dark energy. The difference here is that this is not the dominant energy density in the universe. This is a subdominant energy density, so your effects will be suppressed by that. But there is a resonant growth of fluctuations here. And you can ask the question, how does this impact? Because people had not taken this into account.
So it's not trying to explain
that. It's not trying to explain, it's just showing that these models people have proposed have an extra potentially observational handle where you see this field fragment. And you can not only try to see what the impact on the CMB is, which we have done, but you can also generate some gravitational waves, low frequency gravitational waves. So this is omega GW of 10 to the minus 12. Inflation is, the simplest case is 10 to the minus 14. So this is high, but at very low frequencies. So there's a separate handle. If you're proposing that as a dark energy, as a Hubble tension solution, then this is extra phenomenology there. So it's not a new solution. All right, let me quickly wrap up. So we've only talked about very simple things. I mean, there's a lot more going on during end of inflation and reheating, you know, coupling to other fields that people have mentioned. I don't want to go through all of this in detail, but what I'm going to just flash through, just not as a means of explanation, but as a means that if you guys are interested in this, we can talk a little bit about afterwards. We can talk about what happens to couplings to other fields. Recently, Kalayan has written a beautiful code to include gauge fields in the problem. So this is a code that has gauge fields coupled to, in this case, a complex scalar field which can dominate the energy density of the universe. And we've tried to look at what happens to the electric and magnetic fields. This is an abelian Higgs model. You can also explore the formation of strings and so on. One really nice thing about the code is that the Gauss constraint and energy conservation is absolutely spectacular in this. If you're interested in something like this, I think please talk to Kalayan. There's also nice codes that already exist in a slightly different context by Figueroa et al. And also Adsett et al. And Zach is on one of those papers as well. Okay, I'm going to skip this. This is some work about the fact that the Higgs is fine-tuned. What does it... There's some implications about what this early universe dynamics is. This is with Gigi Fan and Matt Rees. Again, if you're interested, we can discuss this and what kind of gravitational waves it generates. And the sufficiently complex models, I think Eva, you've been interested in this, of course, for a while. We've thought about this as a novel connection between thinking about this models where you don't know all the ingredients, how do you do calculations? There's a connection to Anderson localization where you can calculate current conduction without knowing impurities. So we've try to work on this and try to see if we can learn from that. Most recently, we've been working on trying to calculate what happens to the curvature power spectra in this case from this particle product, repeated particle production. This is more about inflation, less about end of inflation here. But okay, if you're interested, we can discuss. Okay, hopefully I've convinced you, and this you do not need convincing because you were at the workshop, that there's a lot of interesting things to do in this period. I've only talked about some of the simplest things. I've given you some, what I think are quite general results regarding the nonlinear dynamics of these fields, about these instabilities, solitons, and so on, and some novel connections as well. And I think I'm certainly interested in saying, if we can start a conversation, you know, these seem quite general, but what are the implications beyond the ones that I've talked about? I would love to discuss this more and see if we can come up with new ideas where we can, these kinds of dynamics can actually lead to something observational that can be seen not in the infinite distant future, but in the near future. Thanks.